You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 17th of January 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, coming up in the programme.
What I am proposing cannot mean membership of the single market.
UK Prime Minister Theresa May decides what Brexit actually means, but is it what anybody voted for? Also ahead, Syrian rebels agree to attend peace talks, but is this an acknowledgement that there's nothing left worth fighting over? As Inauguration Day looms, we'll speak to a presidential historian about how America's transfer of government assumed the proportions of a coronation. We'll look at what Obama's departure means for the other black Americans who followed him into the White House. And we'll find out what King Felipe VI of Spain brought back from Saudi Arabia. That's all coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. Ahead of all that, a quick look at the day's other big stories. At least 50 people have been killed and many more injured in a misdirected airstrike by the Nigerian Air Force. A pilot who believed he was bombing a gathering of Boko Haram guerrillas near the town of Ran on Nigeria's northern border with Cameroon instead struck a refugee camp. Six Red Cross workers are among the dead. Gambian President Yahya Jammeh has further emphasized his ambivalence about leaving office by declaring a 90-day state of emergency to days before he is due, in theory, to hand over power to Adama Barrow, who defeated him in December's election. President Jammeh, in power since 1994, is challenging the results and insists he will not go before his case is heard in court, which is not possible until May due to a shortage of judges. Russian President Vladimir Putin has insisted that claims that his country's intelligence services hold compromising material on US President-elect Donald Trump are utter nonsense and fake news, and furthermore that those perpetuating the allegations were, quote, worse than prostitutes, in a startling extemporization while dismissing the idea that a man of Trump's bearing would consort with what Putin called our girls of low social responsibility. The Russian president felt it necessary to add, though they are, of course, the best in the world. The large number of follow-up questions which suggested themselves languished sadly unasked. Venezuela has introduced new banknotes of higher denominations in a bid to spare Venezuelans having to carry bags of cash as they search increasingly threadbare shops for things on which to spend it. Inflation in the country is anticipated to reach 1,600% this year. The largest of the new notes is the 20,000 Bolivar, worth just less than $6 on the black market. It is doubtless no consolation to Venezuelans, but they have a way to go before reaching the hyperinflation record set by Hungary in 1946, which was at one point issuing a 100 million pengo bill. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Breaking news as we go to air this evening. US President Barack Obama has commuted the prison term of Chelsea Manning, the American soldier sentenced in 2010 to 35 years for her part in an immense leak of intelligence documents. Manning will now be freed in May. I'm joined by our New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker. Ed, did anyone see this coming?
Bit of a surprise, hey? It's a pretty bold move from Barack Obama, and it's sure to ruffle a few feathers suddenly within the intelligence and armed forces. The fact that someone who's been labelled as a national traitor by some has had their sentence commuted. Having said all of that, it was in many ways a fairly shocking sentence, 35 years, as you just mentioned. Essentially, unprecedented, such a harsh jail sentence handed down for leaking this sort of information. Perhaps in sharp contrast to Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, then known as Bradley, did confess completely to the crimes, and in the hope that the sentence would be less harsh, it didn't work out that way. And so Barack Obama has now stepped in and commuted this sentence, meaning that she will now be released instead of 2045 in May of this year. Quite a change.
Do we know as yet what has motivated Obama's decision? Has he just decided that 7 years was proportionate to the crime committed?
We don't know. We haven't seen any statement on this. I mean, it's perfectly normal for presidents to pardon a whole host of people as they approach the end of their presidencies. So this is in keeping with that. Obviously, the situation is particularly in one sense that, she came out as transgender after being convicted is at Fort Leavenworth, which is an all-male prison. So she's the only transgender member of that prison who hasn't always had access to a doctor, who isn't allowed to keep her hair below a certain length, who has tried to commit suicide a couple of times during 2016. So we don't know. So it would only be speculation, but it might be, that this is a release on compassionate terms, given the uniqueness and difficulty of her imprisonment where she is in Fort Leavenworth.
Ed Stocker in our New York Bureau, thanks for joining us. We will, of course, have much more on that story on The Globalist with Tighe Enright at 7 a.m. London time tomorrow. You're listening to The Daily. Now, declaring that Syria's civil war is even at the beginning of its end would be a bold call. When fighting began in 2011, few imagined that it would last this long or preoccupy the world so much. However, Syrian rebel groups have decided that they will attend peace talks in the Kazakh capital of Astana. The talks are backed by Russia and Turkey. Syria's government has also indicated that it will participate. Well, joining me with more on this is Paul Rogers, Professor of Peace Studies at the University of Bradford. Paul, I will put to you first that impossible and fate-tempting question. Is this potentially the beginning of the end?
I don't think so, but it is certainly a step forward. The people involved in this, I mean, behind the scenes, it is very much Russia and Turkey, who for different reasons want this war to ease up. Neither of them expect it to end. And there is some possibility of things easing and maintaining a lower level in parts of Syria. But there are problems even there in who is to attend. The Turks, for example, are very unhappy about the People's Protection Unit of the Kurds actually taking part. The Iranians are against even a low-level delegation from the United States. So the things to be worked out between now and the 23rd of January. But the real issue, actually, is that a number of the key groups opposed to the Assad regime are not involved in these talks. The umbrella group, the High Negotiating Council, is there, but essentially you have groups like JFS and ISIS, both of whom are engaged in very considerable war against the Assad regime, and of course ISIS in other respects as well. They're not part of this at all. So yeah, in answer to your question, it is not the beginning of the end of the war, but it's certainly something of a step in the right direction, and it might lead to a decrease in the violence, and that is certainly to be hoped for.
Well, indeed so, but in this instance, as you point out, not all the rebels, most notably ISIS, are attending. So when we talk about the rebels who are going to Kazakhstan, who do we mean?
Well, basically, it's a collection of groups. The Free Syrian Army itself is an umbrella group, and that comes in under what is known as the High Negotiating Committee or Council. And this is really something organized by the Saudis, who've been supporting a lot of these groups with money. And the Saudis, to some extent, are calling the shots on this, have insisted that a range of these groups do go forward with. The Free Syrian Army is the kind of representative group. But you have many different militias, and the different sorts of alliances come and go. Many of them are in considerable difficulty, and it is certainly true that the Assad regime is in probably the strongest position it's been in the last 5 years, thanks very largely to ongoing support from Iran and Hezbollah, but crucially to the Russians. And so, in other words, the Assad regime does not really want to negotiate. On the other hand, the Russians are desperate to decrease their forces, extremely costly for them. And the Turks, of course, want a degree of peace to stop the huge flow of refugees across their borders. So each have an interest in this, an interest which may even caused Russia in particular to put pretty heavy pressure on the Assad regime. And this is why there are external factors which are leaning towards a diminution of the conflict, not an end to it by a long shot, but at least a diminution.
The rebels' attendance, then, is this an acknowledgement on their part that they, that basically they're beaten and all that the best they can hope for is to sue for some kind of peace?
I don't think so, no, because of course they know full well that it is not just them who've been opposing the regime. And in fact, for some of the rebel militias, they're particularly worried because groups like Jabhat Fateh al-Sham and indeed to some extent ISIS, but particularly JFS, have been offering the strongest resistance to the Assad regime. Some of these smaller militia groups have actually been joining in with them. So if anything, they've been gathering support. So the wider Free Syrian Army is concerned at that, but it also means that the Assad regime is still under pressure. Also, frankly, the people who are going to Astana, including people from the Free Syrian Army and the broad group of the High Negotiation Committee, they know full well that the Russians, if not wanting out, wanting to have a far decreased involvement. And the Russians do have the capability to put very heavy pressure on the Assad regime. So this is why some degree of compromise might be possible, at least in this aspect of the civil war.
So if the rebels don't think they've lost, does Assad by now think he's won, though? He has spoken about being willing to negotiate on everything, as his spokespeople put it, which does suggest a measure of confidence.
He certainly is far more confident, as I say, is probably in the strongest position in 4 or 5 years and is feeling confident. But he too will know where the real power lies, and the power lies at least in part in Ankara and particularly in Moscow. So he has to pay due deference to what the Russians think, even though he still depends on support from the Iranians. The blunt truth is that if the Russians walked away, then the Assad regime would really struggle and might even fall. The Russians know full well, therefore, that they either stay at great cost or they really force some degree of peace, at least diminishing the level of violence now. The Russians do not think they're ever going to get out, but they don't want to be spending the sheer hundreds of millions of rubles that they're having to expend in Syria at the present time.
Paul Rogers from the University of Bradford, thank you, as always, for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
A new year is upon us and a fresh issue of Monocle is hitting the newsstand. Eager to start the year as we mean to go on, we've packed the February issue full of ideas for how to make our cities and our lives healthier, smoother, and, well, just better. In our 100th issue, we take a whistle-stop tour of three cities designed for healthy living, offer up some lessons, courtesy of a group of Dutch nuns, on how to learn a new foreign language, and we discover the smartest methods out there for making cities safer. The February issue of Monocle will have you shaking off any final vestiges of holiday slumber and sprinting into 2017 well-informed and suitably inspired. Monocle's February issue. Buy your copy today. Happy reading.
This is the Monocle Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House in London. In the 6 months since British Prime Minister Theresa May accepted the ticking parcel of Brexit from her predecessor, she has struggled and or refused to articulate exactly what Brexit will mean, stating only that it meant Brexit, whatever that meant, and reassuring that whatever it did mean, it would be red, white and blue. Ms May has today elaborated on her plans at greater length, if very arguably at no greater sense. Joining me with more are Paul Osborne, regular Monocle contributor, and Charlie Cooper, UK political correspondent with Politico. Before we get into the speech, here is a bit of it.
What I am proposing cannot mean membership of the single market. I do not want Britain to be part of the common commercial policy, and I do not want us to be bound by the common external tariff, but I do want us to have a customs agreement with the EU. And because we will no longer be members of the single market, We will not be required to contribute huge sums to the EU budget.
Charlie, first of all, there was a great deal of what Theresa May said today which made no sense whatsoever to me, so perhaps you can help me with this. First of all, she did say later in the speech, and again sort of there, that staying in the single market would mean by definition not leaving the EU. Now that obviously isn't true, because there are countries which are in the single market and not in the EU, so why did she say it?
I think for Theresa May, she's made very clear since the Brexit vote that her interpretation of what the British people meant when they voted to leave the EU was, above all, that they wanted to control immigration. She said that many times, that that's her interpretation of the key thing that people were voting for when they voted to leave the EU.
That's almost certainly the case, in fairness.
And you can't do that. You can't have full control of immigration from the EU if you're a member of the single market, because European countries have set up their red lines. The key one is the freedom of movement is sacrosanct within the single market. So, in terms of what she thinks the British people meant when they voted to leave the EU, out of the single market is it, because it means we can control immigration now.
Well, Paul, this is another quote from the speech. She said, that is why both sides in the referendum campaign made it clear that a vote to leave the EU would be a vote to leave the single market. That's not true either, is it? In fact, many Leave campaigners were very clear on this. They said that no, only a certifiable moonbat, I paraphrase slightly, would ever vote or wish to leave the single market.
It is not strictly speaking true to say that voters were clearly and loudly told that if we voted to leave the European Union, we would definitely be leaving the single market. And indeed, many people today have been pointing to an interview with Daniel Hannan, who's a Conservative MEP, who was one of the most passionate supporters of leaving the EU, who specifically said, no one is suggesting that we would leave the single market. But having framed the entire debate as being about immigration, about taking control of immigration into the UK, as she said in her speech, that is not compatible with membership of the single market. And every time somebody mentioned a solution like, say, the Norwegian solution or the Swiss solution, the next thing somebody says is, that involves the EU faxing you a list of things you have to do that you had no say in, and would obviously be much worse than the situation we had been in before, when at least we were sat around the table where the decision was being made. So she's trying to frame it positively as a clean break. We are big and powerful and important enough that we're not just going to pull down the Norwegian solution off the shelf, that the other 27 EU member states will be itching to sign a specific deal that gives her all of the things that she wants and none of the things that she doesn't.
Well, on the big and powerful and important note, Charlie, she also said that for the rest of the EU to beat Britain up untowardly, as it left, would be, and I quote, an act of calamitous self-harm for the countries of Europe. Do you think that the countries of Europe perceive that to be the case?
I think that some of the governments within Europe do recognise that they have pretty big industries that depend a lot upon British customers, the German car industry, for instance. I think within Brussels, within the European Union institutions themselves, there's a slightly different view. And the attitude is more towards the sense that we built a European Union through blood, sweat and tears, and somebody's asked to leave it. It's in our interests to make it as difficult as possible for that person who asked to leave to discourage anyone else from wanting to do that. I think that opinion still prevails in Brussels, but you get a slightly softer line in the capitals of some of the 27 other member states. And I think when we go into this negotiation, it's not going to be just Britain against Europe. There's going to be different opinions as to how Europe approaches it within Europe, coming from Brussels, coming from Berlin, coming from Paris, coming from some of the Eastern Bloc. It's going to be 3D chess writ large.
Paul, looking at the speech as a whole, are the mechanics of this departure any clearer than they were? Do we get the sense that anybody yet understands literally how this is going to work?
Well, she set out 12 priorities, and there'll be a test later to see if you can remember any of them. And number one in the priorities was clarity I promise you clarity on the process. I am going to give you a clear explanation of what's going on, the one that I haven't given you for the last 6 months. But she then immediately said afterwards...
No politician's going to say, I promise to waffle and obfuscate till I'm blue in the face.
Well, in the same way that she promised a stronger Britain, as opposed to all those politicians who are arguing for a weaker, smaller, less important Britain. But she said, I am going to give you clarity, except for those occasions where I'm not able to give you clarity, which is the ultimate get-at. What she has clarified, things that we already knew... There isn't going to be an attempt at single market membership because it isn't compatible with immigration. To fail to deliver complete control of immigration would be politically hugely damaging for her. Therefore, single market membership is out. There will definitely be a parliamentary vote, but we don't know when. Is she going to march into Parliament 1 week before the 2 years of negotiations is up and say, here's the deal, take it or leave it? It's either this or it's chaos and World Trade Organization tariffs until we can hammer out an alternative. Is Parliament going to be involved at any stage before that? One of the key criticisms of Theresa May has been she has chosen to interpret the vote of the referendum in her own way. She is not involving Parliament in it. And what perhaps should be a discussion that happens across all political parties and all shades of opinion as to how Britain negotiates its future outside the European Union has become how one subsection of the Conservative Party wants to run Britain post-referendum, post-Brexit. Now, that's partly because of the colossal weakness of the main opposition party that isn't providing any real scrutiny. But it does mean that one of the most important decisions this generation of politicians is going to make is actually being confined to one section of one party.
Charlie, to what extent is Theresa May having to... I mean, she is, if we're going to be sympathetic to her position, in a somewhat impossible position. She feels that she has to deliver on this thing for which there is a mandate. And I guess she's trying to avoid the reality as far as possible that process, that decision, that outcome will likely be economically very bad news for a lot of the people who voted for it. So I guess the question is, how much money does she think Leave voters are personally willing to give up in order to be rid of a relatively small number of foreigners?
That is a question you will not get an answer from her from, I can assure you, in the months I've been covering this story. She will not answer anything like that. Interestingly, on the 12 objectives, I did actually text a Downing Street source yesterday and said that very point. Is there a prize for guessing all 12 objectives correctly? The source sent back £350 million. Cheeky wink.
perhaps they could carve them on least, a giant
least,
stone slab.
At least they've got a sense of humour and Downing Street about all this as well.
For the moment.
For the moment.
They're going to need one, I suspect. On that note, Charlie Cooper and Paul Osborne, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Monocle Daily, live from Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It is now slightly less than 72 hours until Donald Trump is sworn in as the 45th President of the United States. It is somewhat harder than usual to know quite what to expect from the occasion. His soliciting of the traditional A-list entertainers to perform has prompted a stampede in the opposite direction, and the inaugural address could, on form, end up being anything from an infomercial for Trump steaks to an impulsive declaration of war on Greenland. But we can expect a spectacle of some sort. The question is, why does the United States make such a show of changing its government? Well, joining me now is Michael Purdy of the presidentialhistory.com website. Michael, having spent some considerable time on your website this evening, which I'm amazed I didn't know about before now, because I do fancy myself as quite the American history nerd, when did the inauguration become a thing? When did it become an event?
Well, I think it has been changing over time. I mean, if you go back to the very first one of George Washington in 1789, that was actually quite a spectacle. People gathered in New York City. There were fireworks. But of course, over the years, it has become much more of an event where you've got an inaugural parade and you've got inaugural balls. And so those, you know, began really probably in the early 20th century. You started to see more and more of that. It's interesting, Washington's inauguration in 1789, he was the most popular man in the country. And that's, of course, very much contrasted, I think, with what Americans are seeing with Donald Trump's coming inauguration, where his ratings are historically low for a new president.
Isn't the pageantry somewhat at odds with the Republican ideal? It seems to me, at least, to fall on the other side of the discussion that was had among the founding fathers about even how the president should be addressed. And you know, they, of course, obviously settled on the humble Mr. President rather than any sort of European royal formalities.
Sure. Well, there was always a tension, even at the very founding of the country, between more royalist, tones and more Republican tones. And I think the pageantry, though, is something that celebrates the peaceful transition of power from one president to the next. And but certainly you could criticize it for being maybe too much sometimes.
Do you think that symbolism is still important? We're all well and truly used to the idea now that the United States is a constitutional democracy, that power is voluntarily relinquished, that power is peacefully transferred. I mean, obviously, when Washington gave it up to Adams in 1797, that was a fairly, well, in fact, obviously, literally revolutionary gesture. But is reinforcing it to this extent still necessary, do you think?
You know, I think it is. Given you look at just the history of other countries, and certainly in the United States, we've got this pattern with this history of it. But in the history of the world, that is really a very unusual thing still. And I mean, you can just look around the world today, and you can see that that doesn't always happen in other countries. So I think it is something that is worth still celebrating.
In terms of inaugural addresses, and obviously the one that we're bracing ourselves for on Friday is likely to be remarkable one way or another. I think people are familiar with the pantheon of the greats. People think of Lincoln's Better Angels of Our Nature, of Kennedy's Ask Not What You Can Do, etc., etc., even Barack Obama's first inaugural. Is there a pantheon among presidential historians of the worst inaugural addresses?
Well, no, we don't tend to celebrate those as much. you can look at some inaugural addresses. I mean, George Washington, on his second inaugural address, is the shortest on record, just 133 words. And then you can look at what happened in 1841, the oldest man up to that point to be president, William Henry Harrison. He talked for almost 2 hours. Over 8,000 words. He did it on a bitterly cold morning in Washington, D.C. He had no hat, he had no overcoat, and a month later he was dead from pneumonia. So that's one of the stories, kind of droning on, and what some of the impacts of that can be.
William Harrison's speech, I am one of the people who has actually read the whole thing. I set it myself as a sort of endurance test. It was fabulously boring.
well, back then, the language was very different as well. So how people express themselves, it comes across as kind of pompous and difficult to figure out, okay, what are they really getting at? So, yeah.
So what makes a great inaugural speech then? Is there a formula for it that Trump's speechwriter, I believe, Stephen Miller, will have been trying to alchemize as he works through drafts?
You know, I think what makes a good speech, and I'd actually heard at one point that Trump said he was going to write his own speech, so I don't know if he's doing that or if he does in fact have a speechwriter helping him. But I think a good inaugural address captures the moment, it captures the times, and it does it eloquently, and it brings out phrases that are in fact very memorable and that that capture the time. So you can go back to Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 at the depths of the Great Economic Depression. And, you know, his phrase, you know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. And that is what Americans were experiencing, was great fear at that point. And so those were soothing words. Now, and Lincoln's words that you referred to earlier were soothing words trying to bind up the scars that were left after the Civil War. Now, whether we will hear those healing words or not from Mr. Trump remains to be seen. I think if we look at his pattern and the campaign, I guess I would be doubtful that that's something we would hear.
Michael Purdy of presidentialhistory.com, a website I recommend unreservedly. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, the departure of President Barack Obama from the White House will be a melancholy moment for many people, those of us who prefer our nuclear superpowers governed by calm, rational and logical types in the habit of reading unillustrated books, for example. It will be much more so for black Americans, for whom Obama's election in 2008 represented a breakthrough scarcely imaginable for almost all of America's history, and likely even more so than that for the black Americans who have served in Obama's administration. Well, joining me with more on this is Hannah Alam, foreign affairs reporter from McClatchy, D.C. Hannah, you have an article on precisely this subject online now on McClatchy. Who did you speak to for it?
That's right. I spoke to about 20 current and former appointees of the Obama administration about both the highs and the lows, the thrills and the challenges of having served in this historic administration.
Was there a common theme to their recollections? Was there a particular way they characterized their experiences?
Absolutely. While all of them described, you know, the sense of duty that any political appointee serving the government, serving the nation, goes into the job with, they also described this extra sense of purpose, and that was ensuring the success of the first black president of the United States. And this was a personal mission as well as a sort of patriotic mission for them. And they got to see up close sort of the significance of this administration in how people who came to the White House reacted to him, and how when they traveled with him overseas, how he was received in Africa and Asia and many other places around the world. And so they really had this front row seat and part in this historic administration. And it's not something that they'll soon forget.
I would think not. Had they all been able to sustain that sense of purpose and optimism, I guess, because that was always the thing that Barack Obama was going to be burdened by. I was in Philadelphia the night that he was elected the first time in 2008. That was obviously a very good night to be in Philadelphia. And the sense of, I don't think I've ever seen anything approaching it before and likely won't again since, of just exuberance and optimism around a political event, especially among black Americans I spoke to that night. Have they been able to keep all that with them as they ran up against the realities of governance?
I think they have maintained quite a lot of the spirit of that mission and that moment, and certainly they described it very vividly when I asked them about what it felt like. But of course, over the trajectory of this administration, they've taken hits. I mean, just as a lot of black America was devastated by the string of police-involved shootings of unarmed young black men and women. That that feeling pierced the executive bubble, and people, black folks inside the administration, felt the same way and yet couldn't really express themselves candidly because of their sensitive roles. They also had the unwelcome task of, they worked inside the White House by day, and then they'd go home and they'd also have to sort of defend the president's record from people in the black community who said that Obama fell short of, objectives they had, especially on race, on school, on housing, and other issues that were dear to them.
Well, that was, of course, always another bind that President Obama was in and was very much aware of, perhaps hyper aware of, the ironic idea that, in fact, he couldn't be seen to be doing too much to advance the cause of black people in case it appeared too much like he was, he was being a black president rather than the president. How did the people you spoke to respond to that criticism, which I'm sure they heard many, many times?
They certainly did. Two ways. One is that they would explain the hurdles, the many hurdles that they faced in implementing policies, such as, I suppose, chiefly the obstructionism in a Republican-led Congress. But also they would flip the question on the critics and say, what have you done? Do you know who your police chief is? Have you written a letter? These problems are structural and they're old, and they need everyone to do his or her part to fix.
Those you spoke to who had worked with the first family closely and directly, how did they rate them as employers? What were the Obamas like as bosses?
To a person, everyone said they went into the administration really nervous, and here's this eloquent speaker who can electrify a crowd, and his glamorous and sort of approachable wife and their lovely daughters, and so there was this great deal of nervousness. But then they said once you got to work for them, yes, there was a very high standard of work ethic, and you had to meet that bar. But there were also moments of levity that they said the president was very funny, that Michelle Obama is just as warm and approachable off camera as she appears to so many in her appearances on TV.
What are their feelings to the extent that they might have made them known about Obama's successor? Is there any kind of sense that 8 years of whatever progress may have been made has just potentially been thrown into a fairly abrupt reverse?
Well, it's funny. I interviewed about half of the appointees before the election, and there was a very strong sense that Hillary Clinton would win. And so they were much more optimistic sounding about, carrying on Obama's legacy than the batch that I interviewed after the election, where they were sort of filled with this angst of, should I stay or should I go? Should I, take part? Should I be at the table? We worked so hard to get here. It seems a shame to give it up, but at the same time, is staying and working in Washington in any way in support of this Trump administration just normalizing this president who's so problematic to many people of color across America, many others as well?
So what kind of ambitions do these people who've had an absolutely extraordinary experience and do now obviously have, I guess, fairly glittering CVs, what do they look forward to doing next? Do many of them want to stay in public service? Do you get the sense that there's a generation here of future office holders?
I do. And one of them even told me, I firmly believe there's a president in our class, in this class of appointees. Others are going more to the entrepreneurial side. They're launching businesses. Some have started nonprofits that sort of extend their work for the administration. Others are going right back to Capitol Hill to work on sort of preserving what they can of the policies they worked for 8 years against a Congress that's coming in that's overwhelmingly Republican. So they'll have their work cut out for them.
Indeed. So Hannah Allam from McClatchy, D.C., thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We're joined once again by Carlo Bonura, Senior Teaching Fellow in Southeast Asian Politics at SOAS. Carlo, we start with a somewhat melancholy report from the Straits Times. This is the announcement by Australia, China and Malaysia that they are giving up on MH370.
This is an ending chapter to the MH370 saga. It'll be no comfort to the families, this announcement. I think it was it was a long shot that they'd be able to find the plane to begin with, given the amount of space that they were looking at. It's very interesting to think in Malaysia what the political fallout will be. In some ways, the Prime Minister Najib Razak is, the country has faced much larger problems politically in terms of the 1MDB scandal, and it has an election coming up. The families themselves are very, very organized. They're very vocal, but I think in the end, this will be a very sad period in Malaysia's history that will never have any firm answers.
It's one of those stories that really does. I think it has an obvious effect on people because it makes no sense whatsoever. It is the kind of thing which will just nag at people and at a society and at a country and indeed at a world. And the obvious compare and contrast was with the other disaster that Malaysia Airlines had in the same year, which was a bizarre and horrific incident/accident/war crime. But at least you can see how that could have happened. There was an explanation. Grotesque and absurd though it was, but there was an explanation. Whereas I think people still read this story, and I know I do, and think, well, how do you just lose an entire aircraft?
Yeah, and there was a wide variety of explanations that were speculated on. I think some of them were geopolitical and very cynical in nature. Some of them had to do with terrorism. But there's personally, I just feel there's no way for us to know exactly what happened. And even the radar reports that showed it going over the peninsula and ending up in the Indian Ocean, that also doesn't really provide us with any answers.
Okay, well, let's move along now to this is the Asian Correspondent. This is an excerpt of Shinzo Abe's recent whip around Southeast Asia and Australasia. This is Japan's pledge of 6 patrol boats to Vietnam. Now, where is Japan going with this? Is this shoring up its alliance against China?
I think what's happening here is very interesting because what Japan sees is a complete foreign policy vacuum coming out of the United States. The United States for 8 years and even longer has had a certain geopolitical stance toward the South China Sea, against Chinese encroachment, a commitment to what it viewed as very strong allies within the region. And with the Trump, and some of that in the Obama administration played out in terms of the creation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, And then the Trump administration, the changes with the Trump administration has caused so much disruption that it's very interesting to watch the Japanese government simply continue to follow the same foreign policy line, committed to a U.S. status quo, which actually could evaporate in just a matter of days.
The article does note quite correctly that, Japan is one of the very few countries in the region which has no territorial ambitions in the South China Sea. But what would upset Japan about the prospect of Chinese dominance of it?
Well, I think, well, first of all, in terms of the South China Sea is still a very important shipping lane for oil to Japan from the Middle East. So it's important in that regard. It also has other concerns in terms of the disputes with China in its own territorial waters. But I think the key here is that Japan was a critical ally of the United States in terms of providing support to the Philippines, especially against China. And that's why I think that this is about the Japan maintaining a status quo that that it still is invested in geopolitically and is hoping that the United States will actually read these signs that Japan remains committed to what was a very firm American line in the region. And so it may seem as if this is an instance of Japanese aggression or Japan trying to claim a stake here. But I think this is really about preserving a geopolitical position that's already in place.
Okay, well, let's move along to the Bangkok Post. You've brought in an op-ed piece by Surinand Vajajiva criticizing the military government's attempts to turn Thailand back in to a democracy. We should note that Mr. Vajajiva here has something of a vested interest. He did work for the Yingluck Shinawatra government. As he sees it, however, what is the military doing wrong or not doing at all?
Well, in his view, the military simply should turn the country back over to democratic politics. I think what's interesting here, though, is that he's picking up on something that the military has been very, very obsessed with, which is the creation of a wide variety of political infrastructure to try to change politics in the country. Here, his editorial is being sparked by the creation of four new committees related to a variety of political reforms and development. And he actually is arguing that no matter how much the government tries, no matter how many committees and 20-year plans it creates, it actually isn't dealing with the real issue, which is reconciliation. I think personally that this type of reconciliation can only happen under democratic circumstances, but it's also not as simple as is made out to be the case in this editorial either.
I mean, do we get the sense in general, though, that Thailand's military are going anywhere anytime soon?
I don't have any sense of that, no. And in fact, these infrastructures, these 20-year, they have a 20-year plan in place. They have five different political institutions designed to manage politics in the country, the creation of the new constitution, the management of succession. They're certainly here to stay for a very long time.
Well, let's move along to the Jakarta Post, which is reporting on the intention of Jakarta's police to have a word with Islam Defenders Front leader Rizieq Shihab. He has been among those mounting the somewhat bizarre and peculiar campaign against Jakarta's Governor Ahok. Is this the legal establishment getting a couple of blows back in?
I think it is. This is a lot of it is a organized pushback against Rizieq Shihab, and it's very interesting because he now faces, I think, three or four cases, one of which is related to blasphemy against comments he made against Christianity during Christmas time.
Well, that's a pleasant irony if he's on the hook for blasphemy as well. This does suggest that some prosecutor somewhere has a sense of humor, doesn't it?
A sense of humor. I mean, in my sense of the situation, the Indonesian government really needs to push back hard against groups like the Front Pembela, Islamic Defenders Front. It has been gaining in power and in its capacity to kind of mobilize the Islamic or Islamist street in Indonesia over the last decade. And although this appears to be trying to catch Shihab in his own trap in terms of blasphemy and hate speech, in fact, it's not really enough. The Jokowi needs to come out more forcefully against these groups and really draw a line and say that this type of intimidation regarding religion is not acceptable.
It's a fine balance, though, isn't it? Because if you start taking these people seriously, then other people take them seriously as well. And you can make them a bigger and bigger thing by trying to shut them down.
Yeah, but I think that in this case, they're already taken very seriously and they have a lot of support within the political establishment in Indonesia. Jokowi's risk is that by engaging with this too directly, that he actually provides his enemies with an opening for even more political attacks.
Okay, well, finally and briefly, we turn back to the Straits Times. This is a bad news day for HSBC, at least if Greenpeace have got it right in what they're saying.
Right. This is a very interesting report. Greenpeace argues that HSBC loans have ended up in companies which are actively involved in deforesting and in promoting illegal burning in Indonesia. The haze is a massive problem. Greenpeace has prioritized deforestation in Southeast Asia for a while now. But what's interesting about this is that the new tactic is to actually follow the money because they know that the money will end up in hands that it shouldn't end up in, and actually then come back to HSBC and make very clear arguments about how they're involved in fostering illegality. And so this seems to me, in terms of combating environmental degradation, to be a very, very effective policy, and one which banks like HSBC can't simply dismiss outright.
Carlo Bonura from SOAS, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
Okay, so 2016 wasn't the greatest of years, but don't worry, there are plenty of reasons why 2017 will be better. And we've packed lots of them into more than 250 pages of the new edition of the Monocle Forecast. It's the magazine for those who want to look over the horizon and spot the new opportunities the new year will bring. From the rising global powers to keep an eye on, to the startups to invest in, and the cities you'll want to call home. It's packed with opinion and wit, with ideas and provocations, and guaranteed to keep you talking all the way through 2017. The Monocle Forecast. Buy your copy today and know what's happening tomorrow.
You are listening to The Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Finally tonight, King Felipe VI of Spain is now able to add the collar of King Abdul Aziz Al Saud to the already hefty chestful of baubles he is entitled to sport at ceremonial wingdings. It is, for the moment at least, the most tangible souvenir of his visit to Saudi Arabia, which ends today. But what was Felipe really doing there, and how impressed will his subjects be with the company he has been keeping? I'm joined now by Monocle's man in Madrid, Liam Aldous. Liam, I guess two questions in one to start with. What is Spain selling and why are the Saudis buying it?
Well, everyone is talking about this much-anticipated deal to sell Avanti 220 corvettes, which are massive warships for a total of 2 billion euros. So, I mean, that's a pretty good reason to go to Saudi Arabia to kind of smooth out that deal. That nothing was agreed upon, but hopefully Felipe is coming back with a smile on his face because it's a lot of money to be injected into the Spanish economy. But there's another bigger project. Spain is also involved in the 22.5 billion euro Riyadh Metro project, actually leading the consortium, and that's one of the biggest infrastructure projects going on in Saudi Arabia at the moment. And there's also trouble because the high-speed rail line, which Spain is also leading to Mecca, has had so many troubling issues. It's basically they're building a high-speed rail network across the sandy desert. You can imagine the amount of problems involved as far as engineering goes. And he's basically just trying to reassure his Saudi partners that all these projects will be delivered in time because they're running overdue at the moment.
All of which is obviously, as you say, good news for the Spanish economy, which obviously needs all the help it can get. But whenever a democracy does business with Saudi Arabia, there's a certain amount of grumbling back home from people demanding to know what we're doing business with a regime which is, let's face it, fairly awful. Is King Felipe having to cope with any of that?
Not yet. Spain has such a long relationship with the Saudi Arabians. There are obviously some critical voices around, but it's just been seen as the norm. This relationship stretches back so long, because the former king of Spain used to be so friendly with the former king, it's just been most Spanish have grown up with such a close relationship. However, because of the defense contracts involved, especially these warships, the most of the criticism has been directed against this mooted sale of warships. Some people even saying that it could break international law because of Saudi Arabia's current actions in Yemen. So a lot of that analysis will probably start tomorrow when Felipe is back in Spain, and he'll be able to open the morning paper and read about whether the Spanish journalists at least are satisfied with his trip.
Was there any other controversy attached to the trip? I did read that there was the apparently obligatory row over a woman wanting to wear clothes.
Yeah. I mean, it comes as no surprise. The lady in question was actually Spain's State Secretary of Commerce, Maria Luisa Poncela. She wore what was described as a mini skirt in local media, but was just a short dress in an official meeting behind closed doors, as custom actually permits official delegations to wear their normal dress, which is just normal dress, behind closed doors. She wasn't out in public, but they played down the team with a confected outcry, just saying that Federica Mogherini was actually in Saudi Arabia and was something similar, and referred to Michelle Obama's very controversial trip and tried to play it down so it didn't overshadow the king's accomplishments or yet to be announced accomplishments. I should correct that.
Finally, then, to the king himself in general terms, as far as it's possible to tell, have the Spanish public taken to him yet?
So it's been very, I personally have been quite frustrated with the strategy from the royal household, because they seem to be waiting in the wings for this big court case, very damaging to the king's sister and her husband, a corruption trial. Out in the Spanish courts. I think once this is all put to bed, and maybe perhaps his brother-in-law is put in jail, you might see the royals emerge and have a bit of a cleaner air and being able to actually do more things. They're doing a very official role, but they're really not showing much personality. So it's hard for the Spanish to warm to the monarchy when they are being so official.
Liam Aldous, our man in Madrid, thank you for joining us. And that is it for today's edition of The Monocle Daily. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello. The researchers were researched by Jolene Goffin. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now with Ty Genwright. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.